Okay, the next argued case is number 21-1609, Roche Diagnostics Corporation against Mesoscale Diagnostics, LLC. Mr. McKean.
Thank you, members of the court. My name is James McEwen. I represent Roche Diagnostics Corporation and BioVeris Corporation. I'd like to focus in my time today on three errors in the district court below: the misinterpretation of the license, the lack of evidence with respect to inducement, and the damages issue. First, with respect to the license agreement, the interpretation that the district court erroneously allowed was that the provisions of this license agreement transferred from Igen to Mesoscale all rights for all purposes under the agreement, the 1995 license. Even if that license language were ambiguous, which the district court held on the summary judgment standard, Delaware law requires that then you look at the course of conduct before the dispute arose.
Okay, I guess I hate to interrupt, but the time is short, and as you said, you had a number of issues. So can I move you on to the inducement question?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. First, on the legal backdrop of this, you argue Judge Stark referred to the principle of Standard Oil, that you can't go outside, Judge Rich telling us you can't go outside the period. And then he went on to add a causation standard, right? Am I reading it right? And your first argument is that he erred because Standard Oil doesn't have a causation standard and it should just be full stop. Outside the period, you can't count it.
That's part one, Your Honor.
Okay.
Correct. And part two is the causation.
Let me move to part two.
Yes.
Because it seems like one could fairly read Standard Oil as not necessarily precluding that. I mean, I haven't gone back to the briefs in this 1996 case, but it didn't appear to me, based on the opinion, that that was even argued or presented, that the other side wasn't pressing, well, even though it's outside the period, there's a causation element, we've proven that, yada-da-da-da. So assume for a second that we don't think we're bound by, we're precluded Standard Oil from doing the causation. What say you about the causation or their lack thereof?
Well, first of all, Standard Oil, the catalyst was soiled more than 6 years earlier and was barred. There was the issue there with respect to whether or not that could be an act of inducement within the limitations period. Secondly, with respect to the causation, there's a need to show that the act of inducement caused the direct infringement by the customers. Because the challenge here was with respect to...
And what did Judge Stark tell us about that? Why did he find there was sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that?
Judge Stark allowed, he deferred to the jury, but he relied on conduct in 2007.
Correct.
That said that it was possible that they could infer from that. But it didn't account for the fact that over this period of time, by Mazo's own expert, sales grew by over 1,000%. And so the removal of a label and a press release and a customer letter in 2007, there's no way that there was anything in the record to permit a jury to find that those caused all of the out-of-field
uses.
Well,
the label
later
was removed in 2007, but it continued to be absent for the entire inducement damages period. So is that not, why is that not sufficient?
It's not an active inducement at that point. It's just the removal of the label. And again, that goes to the question of which customers out of all these customers would have even known there was once a label. It's not the question, there was no evidence with respect to which customers were affected or not affected during this period. Some of this is 10 years after that label was removed. And these instruments were permissible even if Mazo has the license rights for all in-field uses by hospitals.
Okay. Let me move you to the intent prong, because that's an area of some confusion because it overlaps the inducement and also the willfulness in that. So you want to address that, which is kind of confused in the record, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It seemed confused in the record as to what standard was used, whether it was the appropriate standard, and if it wasn't, how that may have affected the inducement.
Well, with respect to the intent issue, Your Honor, a little bit of history on how we moved through the process might help, which was at the discussion of the jury instructions, one of the arguments we made was that there had to be some provision in the jury instruction that if Roche had a good faith basis to believe that it had the rights it needed, that was a complete defense. And that was included in the jury instructions that then went to the jury. On the JMOL, however, the court, while finding in the non-appealed part by Meso that there was no basis to find that Roche did not have a good faith basis for its conduct and what it was doing, the judge did not apply that standard. He did it should have known standard and applied that to uphold the jury verdict. So you
The jury instruction you just referred to, did that apply to both the willfulness question and the inducement question, or what?
That was the instruction for the inducement question, Your Honor.
For the inducement question.
Yes, it was not originally in the instruction added.
Isn't the question of law whether knowledge of how it's being used is probative or prima facie or whatever of inducement?
Under this court's Connell standard, we believe that it is. There has to be the knowledge that it is being used improperly.
Yeah.
Is your answer that it's not just knowledge that it's being used, but knowledge that it's being used improperly?
Used and improperly. I'm sorry, yes. Because the issue goes to these instruments are all being placed, again, at hospitals, clinics, locations that are testing for diagnostic purposes. And was there, for example, if it's in a university hospital, some professor who's running a group of test tubes at night for some out-of-field use, research.
Can I just ask you to clarify, because there are all these separate issues, and I know I moved you off of the license issue, but how, if at all, does the license issue play on this? Is it your position that even if we lose the license issue, and Chief Judge Stark was right, that we have to defer to the jury, the closeness of the license issue, if we conclude it was really close, affects the ability to have a willfulness standard and certainly an inducement standard of knowledge?
The three different arguments that I referenced, the license, the inducement, and damages, are all three separate independent bases for a reversal. Without the license interpretation, and again,
But I'm saying let's assume we agree that we can uphold the license piece of it, that there was enough for the jury, but let's assume we also conclude that it was a close question. And that's what Stark said in connection with willfulness, right? That the license stuff, you had a basis for a reasonable belief because the license thing at a minimum was a close call.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question.
Okay,
yeah, I mean, that goes exactly to the intent issue on the inducement, which was there was a reasonable basis. He found on summary judgment there was a reasonable basis for either interpretation. And on the willfulness, which was not appealed by Meso, he reversed the jury finding, saying that there was no basis in the record by which any jury could find anything other than Roche had a good faith basis to believe it held all the rights it needed for these products that it was selling.
Does the fact that they haven't... I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Turner.
Can I ask you, I guess this is a little bit related to the license, just a little bit.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Assume for the moment that the 729 and the other seven patents,
779.
That we conclude that there's no basis for infringement, but that there is a basis for an infringement finding for the 939, the material claim. Does that change in the basis of infringement call all by itself for a redo of damages?
Yes, it would, Your Honor, because the way that the damage base was calculated, there was no attempt by Mr. Mims, the expert for Meso, to separate which sales were attributable to which of the patents, except for that last tail period where there's $12 million. For that
the tail period when the 939 is still alive, but the other two are dead.
Exactly, Your Honor. But so there's everything before then. They were claiming that all of the patents were covering. I think one of the patents expired.
Was it agreed or disputed between the parties that all of the products during the pre-tail period were covered by all three patents?
Well, not all products are covered by a 939. That's a much narrower patent, Your Honor.
Where does the evidence say that?
The discussion of the 939, and it's also in, I believe Mr. Offenloch or Dr. Offenloch of Roche discussed it, and Dr. Wilbur from Meso discussed it. That relates to a particular type of ruthenium label. The other two patents, the 729 relates to microparticles, and all of the Roche instruments use microparticles as part of this process, and the 779 relates to tripropylamine or TPA, and every commercial use of ECL, electrochemiluminescence, necessarily uses TPA.
I would be interested, just and maybe when you get up on rebuttal, if you can actually point to something in the joint appendix that says not every sale by Roche involved the 939?
Yes, Ron. I think the limiting for the ongoing royalty, it was defined for which particular products. But I believe Mr. Mims separated out in the second half.
Well, I just let me take Judge Toronto's question, wishful thinking perhaps, a step further. Like, is there any, when they decided what the basis was there any differentiation between which patents covered what and what portion of that? Specifically, I don't care about I don't care about the difference between 779 and 729. I'm looking for a distinction between 739. Is there anything in the record as it exists now to give us an indication, if we were to conclude hypothetically that the 939 is the only one continued in play, is there a basis in the record to
the only thing in the record, Your Honor, with the 939 are the sales revenues after after 1217. And again, this goes into they had no royalty rate expert opinion, they had no comparable license. The Omega case is directly on point for that. There are over 100 patents, and in addition, there's nothing for apportionment to consider all of the effects of the various other aspects of these Roche instruments, including the Roche scientists.
Well, Judge Stark, as I'm recalling, seemed to rely heavily, maybe I'm just recalling what the red brief says, about how it was a substantial driver of demand, that this was a key feature.
Your Honor, and that goes to Plaintiff's Exhibit P-424, and that's an excellent example of when you read the rest of the document, or sometimes when you read the rest of the testimony beyond what has been quoted in the briefs by Meso, the very next section with a heading talks about the test menu. And the test menu is these Roche scientists have been working since the early 90s to have different types of heart tests, maternity tests, all these various tests, and there's testimony by Dr. Ballas that the competitors of Roche, Siemens and Abbott, competition is as to the breadth of menu, how many tests you have when you're competing with folks. That has value. There was nothing in the record that Meso offered, and it was their burden to try to apportion what value of the total profits of Roche on this product line for these sales was attributable to all that menu. And that document that the judge cites.
What does our case law say? Because I think what the judge said is, I don't know if this is a substantial driver, this is an absolutely key feature necessary to the interest a consumer would have in this. What does our case law say about how strong that has to be in order to align?
Your case law suggests that essential is not sufficient. Just because something is essential or necessary, that's not enough. And it also suggests that under FinJAN, that you have to look at what is the value attributable in this case to these three patents as opposed from all the other 100 plus patents, all the Roche contributions, and that was Meso's burden. And to go back to that P-424, that was the evidence Judge Stark was referring to, and that was, and then the very next paragraph talks about all these other attributes as well as that other testimony I cited. I see I'm eating into my rebuttal time.
Can I just ask you one more question about
Your
the license, the allegedly comparable license? I mean, the license, the 65% that comes out of a license that Judge Stark relied on, right, to substantiate, to confirm the verdict? Was there the testimony on that? Was there testimony back and forth about the coverage of 100 patents, et cetera?
Yes, and the license is in evidence. The license was Exhibit P-44. There's 27 pages worth listing all the licenses that are covered by that. And that was included as part of the Iagen Roche deal from 2003 when Roche paid Iagen $1.4 billion for that license and paid nothing to Meso.
And Meso consented to that agreement?
They consented to that agreement. And in addition, Your Honor, important at that period of time is that Mr. Wallstatter wrote a memo that was cited on by Vice.
This is Wallstatter Jr.?
It's Mr. Jacob Wallstatter. I'm sorry. Yes. Wrote a memo in which seven different times he refers to Iagen granting that license, not Meso granting that license. And they now claim that Meso has those rights. And that was Exhibit D-159, was relied on by Vice Chancellor Parsons in the Chancery Court case. And I see I've now gone.
Okay, well, we'll save your rebuttal time, and let's hear from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hughes.
Good morning, John Hughes for Mesoscale. And I think I'd like to start with what Judge Prost started with the causation question on inducement. And I agree, Judge Prost, with your suggestion that Standard Oil certainly does not prevent the jury.
Let me just say, I was just putting it out there for debate.
Sure.
That's not necessarily my.
But can I actually start on that? Because this is actually the threshold. So as the second to last paragraph of Standard Oil says, Nippon is the accused induced infringer, and there's one clear, too early piece of direct infringement. But the second is, we assume arguendo in determining the propriety of the grant of summary judgment, that Rome and Haas committed direct infringement in connection with the operation of the Texas plant beginning in November 1976. That is the month of the six-year period. So isn't there why doesn't that language indicate the assumption in Standard Oil that there was direct infringement in the six-year window, and the court says, nevertheless, the inducing act was outside the window, done?
They do assume it arguendo, so we don't know for sure.
Case is decided on the basis of an assumption.
But what I would say is that the reason that doesn't foreclose the jury instruction that Judge Stark gave in this case is because he gave the causation element of the instruction, which required any conduct that occurred prior to the damages period to be connected to the direct infringement that occurred during the damages period, which was the only basis for the damage award in this case, were instances of direct infringement, so sales during the damages period.
And JMOL is not decided on the basis of the jury instruction. It's decided on the basis of the correct law. Like we've said that, the Supreme Court has said that.
I agree. Whether or not the jury instruction was correct is de novo review. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But Judge Stark gave a correct instruction because that causation element requires it to continue into the damages period so that there's a connection between.
Okay, well, I got you sidetracked. You were about to discuss
with Judge
Prost about the actual work on the causation question.
It's sum and substance of the same thing, and the reason why it makes sense in this case is as follows. In 2007, Roche acquired BioVaris for about $600 million. The primary purpose of that transaction was to gain access to the clinical trial and research field for ECL, what we claim is our exclusive field, and the jury agreed with that. When that happened in 2007, Roche not only took off the label, they not only told all their customers they could use the products for whatever they wanted in an unrestricted manner, more importantly, Roche told its entire global sales force that they now had access to the human diagnostics field into new markets such as life science research, drug development, and clinical trials. And they went on to tell that global sales force, please ensure that the people in your organization involved in Alexis sales and marketing activities are fully aware of the new situation and that they are now free to develop and exploit these new sales opportunities. That's at Appendix 5901.
Okay, but where's the evidence that 4 years later, anybody who did the direct infringement, the purchasers, that Roche told anybody anything, that his sales force told anyone anything? What I saw in the record was simply one of their officers acknowledging that that was true, but certainly not that there was any evidence, any indication that any of the sales in the relevant six-year period were induced or related to those, whatever was said or done in 2007.
Well, let me answer that a couple of ways. The jury knew, and it was undisputed, that Roche continued to sell all during the damages period in an unrestricted manner, and that some of those sales were in the clinical trial and research field. And I believe the jury was permitted to infer from what the global sales force was told in 2007 that it followed those directions and continued to move sales into that new market, into the clinical trial market.
Yeah, but where's the inducement in that situation?
It's the active selling of the products for use in the clinical trial and research field as they were instructed to do in 2007. The jury can conclude that they continued to follow that instruction during the damages period. And then to your question, the flip side of that is that there's a willful blindness component of the inducement instruction. And the evidence that the jury was presented was that prior to 2007, Roche tried to track where its sales went, whether they were for patient diagnostics or the clinical trial slash research field. After 2007, when it acquired BioVeris, it was willfully blind. It quit tracking those sales. That's evidence of the record.
Can I just ask you about this? Do I understand correctly that for the 729 and the 779 method patent claims at issue that if you are going to use the Roche machine, you are going to be practicing those claims?
That is correct, and I think Roche concedes that.
Okay, so that the only thing left for being for deciding whether a sale would go outside the field of use restriction is just knowing the use to which the running of the machine was going to be put. And if it was research, then it was automatically going to be infringing.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's not like a selection of uses once you sell it to the researcher.
Correct. I mean, that's correct. I will say, let me point the court to evidence about Lab Corporation, which is one of Roche's biggest customers. They have ECL instruments, and sometimes those are used for patient diagnostics, and sometimes those are used for clinical trial research. And so every time that an assay or reagent pack is run through the ECL for a clinical trial.
So the same customer may be doing one or the other.
Many of them are, and that's an important issue related to damages. But as to LabCorp, one of Roche's biggest customers, there was evidence in the record at Appendix 4658 and 4663 that Roche knew they were selling to LabCorp, obviously one of their biggest customers, and that during the damages period, Roche knew that customer was using the ECL assays for clinical trial work. So Roche knew all about
this.
And
what about the intent prong? And we discussed it a little with your friend. We have Judge Stark saying on the record that there was no willfulness. I understand you didn't appeal it, but he said it. There was a good faith belief. And let's assume that we construe the back and forth on the licenses as being a close call. I mean, two reasons. You may win on that narrow issue, but I think that's what Stark indicated he thought. How do you get to willful blindness or knowledge of intent under those circumstances?
Well, so at first, I guess first of all, and I don't take your question to suggest otherwise, that the standard for intent under inducement is not the same as the standard for intent under willfulness with the maliciousness and conduct of a pirate type requirement. But to get at the question of the license issue, we think there was evidence in the record that Roche knew full well that Mesoscale had exclusive license rights under the 1995 agreement. And I would point, and that's what the jury was permitted to rely on for not only intent on inducement and on willfulness, and we didn't appeal that because Judge Stark indicated he would never enhance. But the best
but
evidence.
What was his statement in reference to good faith belief? that Roche had good faith belief that, as to what?
That it relates to the license rights. And I think if evidence is, if inferences are drawn in Mesoscale's favor, I would point the court to Appendix 5680, which is a 2001 memo.
You're going to have to tell me which volume that's in.
I don't know which volume. I know the page number, which is 5680, which was a trial exhibit. And it's cited in our brief in many instances, it's a 2001 memo from the due diligence team to Franz Humer, who at the time was the CEO of Roche Diagnostics. And in that memo, the due diligence team looks at the very contracts that were at issue in the trial, including the 1995 license agreement that gives us the exclusive license rights. And in the due diligence memo to the CEO, the due diligence team says, ECL rights for use in many, if not most, point-of-care applications, and iGen's publicly stated views, one of its key values, have been licensed exclusively to MSD, Mesoscale Diagnostics. So Roche knew all the way back in 2001 that there was an exclusive field that belonged to Mesoscale. Now, that field was a little bit different in 2001 because it was subject to a license that was the predecessor of 2003, but nothing about the operation of Section 2.1 in the 1995 license agreement changed after 2001, and Roche knew that too, because by the time we got to 2003...
Okay, but I understand, and we've read the briefs, but if we accept Judge Stark's conclusion that Roche had a good faith belief, is a finding of willful blindness possible?
I do think it is certainly possible in the sense that Roche wasn't tracking whether or not it was selling ECL products into the clinical trial field versus the patient diagnostics field where they have an unlimited right to do whatever they want. So that's willful blindness in the sense it's not keeping track of whether the sales that it's making are being put to an infringing use, and I think that is sufficient evidence.
It's willful blindness even if there's a good faith belief?
Well, I guess determining that there is a good faith belief would require a rejection of the jury following the inducement instruction, which included a provision that if Roche had a good faith belief, that was a defense to inducement. And I think drawing inferences in our favor, there is substantial evidence to support the conclusion that Roche knew full well that there were exclusive rights to Mesoscale and just bypassed those by not dealing with Mesoscale in 2007.
Okay, and I'm sorry. I know I've taken your time. Unless my colleagues disagree, I'd just like you to say a little about the apportionment issue in connection with the damages before you have to sit down. How do we get around? I mean, this is if Judge Stark felt that he had to affirm the verdict by going to this earlier license of 65%, and then, I don't mean manipulative in a pejorative way, but then manipulate the base to this or more, which could be arguably speculative. How do we get there, given our case law, because the other license contained 100 patents?
So, first of all, I don't think we even need to get to the 65% license in order to affirm the jury's verdict, because Judge Stark talked about this as well in the very next paragraph. The way that the jury divided up the value here was that Roche's ability to access the clinical trial field was super important for it to make sales in the patient diagnostic field. There were tremendous convoyed sales. And the way this works is that about 90% of the sales dollars in this market come from the sales of the assays, the reagent packs, not the big platforms. And if you go to a dual-use customer like LabCorp and you want to sell a platform and you lose the platform sale because of the restriction on clinical trial fields, then you lose all of the follow-on sales, not just clinical trial, but all the patient diagnostic sales. And so
that takes us back to what you can tell is troubling me. You're still saying that knowledge or likelihood or probability is enough without saying, use it this way.
Well, I think that there was evidence in the record that the jury can infer the sales force was telling them to use it in a particular way, and that was the basis for the inducement. But to get back to, if we do get, Judge Post, to the 65% license, I think the way to look at that is that the 2003 license, which had the 65%, purported to keep Roche out of the clinical trial field, our field, and if they went into that field, they had agreed to pay 65%. The patents at issue in the hypothetical negotiation, Roche agrees, blocks them from the clinical trial field. That's what's getting divvied up at the hypothetical negotiation, is access to the clinical trial field. And their suggestion that the other patents matter is belied by the fact that they own those patents, and the only other potential party with a claim to rights to those patents is Mesoscale. And we have agreed in the district court and our briefs here that we are only seeking damages for the sales that occurred during the damages period, and we wouldn't seek them based on any of those other patents. So in other words, the outcome of this case is freedom to operate in the damages period from any claim that Mesoscale has, and which is the exact same thing as the outcome of the hypothetical negotiation, which is access to the clinical trial field, which makes the 65% relevant, but more importantly, it makes all of those convoyed sales, which the jury could conclude vastly exceeded the clinical trial sales, part of what was divided up.
One final question, and this is a follow-up to the question that Judge Toronto pressed with your friend, was assuming hypothetically that we're left only with the 939 patent in infringement. Well, what are we to do with the damages? What is there enough in the record to divvy up or to differentiate between the damages with respect to 939 and the other patents? Just a new trial on damages?
I think, I certainly hope you don't reach that conclusion, but if you do, I think realistically it would require a new trial, because Mr. McEwen is correct that the 939 applies to a subset of the reagent packs that Mesoscale offered, whereas the other patents cover all of the platforms
and
all
of the reagent.
And there's
nothing in the record here that resolves that differentiation.
There is some differentiation on the tail end, because the 939 patent lasted longer. I think Judge Toronto alluded to that, but there wouldn't be a way to disaggregate the numbers from before that, in all candor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, let me address a couple of initial points. You asked about the 939, where the records talked about the revenues. That's discussed by Mr. Mims at appendix page 4416 and by Mr. Jarris at appendix page 4786. The apportionment issue and the statement counsel just made about freedom to operate is very interesting with respect to their cross appeal as well, because he said that they're freedom to operate for the sales at issue, and yet they're cross appealing on three patents that were included within our complaint for declaratory judgment. In their footnote on their reply brief on page 13 says those patents cover all these products at issue. They're all issued prior to this period, and there's no effort to apportion them out either. With respect to the 2001 memo that was cited to you by counsel, again, this is taking a statement out of context. It talks about point of care. That was at exhibit P105, appendix 5680. The Roche instruments are large instruments. They're not point of care instruments, and Dr. Keller, I specifically asked him this question at the end of his redirect, and it can be found at appendix 4542. None of the instruments at issue in this case are point of care instruments. So pointing to a 2001 memo that says that the meso rights affect point of care doesn't do anything as to the Roche instruments, which are using the flow cell technology that had pre-existed before any of these licenses. Similarly, on the causation question that was asked, the Roche executive that was referenced was Mr. Griffin, and he was given the hypothetical of what would you say if asked, but he also testified again at appendix 4662 that customers don't ask this question. And so there's nothing in the record that Meso put in, and they bear the burden to show that issue. And
Could you address the your colleague's point about the convoyed sales? Let's sentence or paragraph in Judge Stark's damages discussion. It's not lengthy, and he didn't use that term, but I think that's a correct description of his sentence.
That is, I believe that is the term or the concept that Judge Stark talked about. But again, there needs to be the concept of a convoyed sale is maybe if you have some sales in this new area, you would also get greater sales for other products. But there wasn't any estimate of what that was, and there was no basis. And there has to be a reasonable basis in the record that the claimant, in this case Meso, puts in so that you can determine what part of the profits of Roche are attributable to these three patents and nothing else. And to say that, well, there were convoyed sales without some estimation of them, or without showing exactly how they tied, is that would mean every time an expert came in, they could say, my estimate is conservative, and that would set the limits, and you could get however high a verdict that a jury would award. And that's not the rule. The rule is there has to be a reasonable basis in the record. And finally, I just want to spend just a moment on the cross appeal. The three patents at issue were all...
I don't think they covered the cross appeal. Did they speak to the cross appeal?
I don't believe he did, no.
No, it's not reflected. Tell us what you want to tell us in case we need to know.
I was just going to say, in the cross appeal, those three patents were attached. It was clear from the complaint, including footnote one, that the declaratory judgment was brought after the Chancery Court trial, after the threat by Meso's counsel to bring a patent infringement case. This line of products were at issue, and therefore it triggered the compulsory counterclaim rule, and that Judge Stark properly held that by not bringing a compulsory counterclaim, they waived.
As I understand it, they make two points. One, that this was not a compulsory counterclaim, but even zero, before they get to one, this is not the right court to make that judgment. It ought to be, in fact, has to be, I think is their argument, only the second court when they assert those patents. And that second court would entertain a motion from you to dismiss on the ground that they lost that right because they failed to bring it as a compulsory counterclaim. What about that procedural point?
They are correct that this court has not addressed that question. The fact that the context usually comes up as a motion to dismiss in the second case. The Eighth Circuit in the Xinjiang decision said that you could enter the declaratory judgment and the judgment in the first case.
Do we have any Third Circuit law which perhaps would have something?
Probably the Eighth Circuit, more bearing than the Eighth Circuit. No, I only use the Eighth Circuit because of the context of a patent claim prior to all the counterclaims coming to this court.
Are there other courts that have said court number one can enter a judgment on compulsory counterclaim grounds like this?
Not that we've seen, but this is also rather unique in that they're now saying they are going to bring this case, and Judge Stark knew what the products or processes were at issue. It's the entire Roche line, and given the history of litigation between these parties, bringing an end to this would be useful as a matter of Rule 1.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. McCann?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCann. Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission.